One of the many reasons people travel is to observe history. Tourists wait for hours in line to see the names of their immigrant ancestors at Ellis Island. They visit castles or exhibitions of Egyptian artifacts. But some historical eras are not well marked by monuments or museums. Their secrets dwell in the everyday streetscapes of everyday neighborhoods. Take the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s. It was a time of unprecedented cultural achievement for African Americans. These days, it's hard to find evidence of the Roaring Twenties and the fervor of what was called the New Negro Movement. Unless you have the right tour guide, as did the Savvy Traveler's Marianne McCune.
When Michael Adams walks down a Harlem street, he has a kind of X-ray vision. He sees back in time.
You know, it's like that poem by Robert Louis Stevenson. The child is on the seashore and he's digging holes in the seashore and he says, "In every place I dug my cup and every place the sea came up." Every place you look in Harlem, there's all this history just waiting there to be uncovered.
Walk the streets of Harlem without Adams and you'll see the usual urban landscape, the noisy traffic, the jumble of merchants, a few burned out buildings, some littered empty lots. Add Michael Adams to the mix and you might find inspiration. It's late morning and Adams points me toward the imposing facade of a neo-Gothic church near 138th Street and 7th Avenue. An immense stained glass window looms overhead.
Right there is the Abyssinian Baptist Church, actually built by African Americans by the Reverend Adam Clayton Pyle Sr.
Abyssinian is one of several nearby churches that helped transform Harlem into a black community. On this day, hundreds of well-dressed parishioners crowd into its wooden pews and join hands to sing a century-old hymn written by a forefather of Harlem's Renaissance, James Weldon Johnson. "Lift Every Voice and Sing" is sometimes called the Negro National Anthem.
I love to hear the spirituals sung in our church because they tell a story of our struggle.
Reverend Calvin Butts is the pastor of the church, and he welcomes tourists and visitors to its balcony. Here, you can witness traditions that marry Harlem's history to its present.
It says, "Shadow beneath thy hand, with this God of our weary years and this God of our silent tears, shadow beneath that God's hand, may we forever stand true to that God." And then it says, "True to our native land." Now, what's our native land? It's America. It's America.
When tour guide Michael Adams talks about the Harlem Renaissance, his sometimes cynical eyes light up behind thick glasses. As a gay, black intellectual coming of age in the Midwest, Adams says he never imagined he could find himself in history until he read about the black men and women who broke all the rules to make Harlem their Mecca in the 20s.
The thing that's so inspirational about the Harlem Renaissance and about Harlem's emergence as a black community is that, you know, you've got all of these people who see Harlem as an opportunity to achieve their aspect of the American dream. And they don't act in a passive way to achieve that. They really do act actively to bring about the transformation of this place into their community.
We turn onto 139th Street, a beautiful block of 3- and 4-story brick row houses with polished wooden doors and elegant cast iron balconies. These were among the last houses in the neighborhood to admit African Americans as residents. When the stubborn company that owned them finally gave up its quest for white buyers, Harlem's black doctors and dentists and otherwise well-to-do hurried to move in, even if it meant taking in boarders to survive.
Just like any school child, who, you know, if you tell them, "Don't smoke, don't drink," it becomes the most irresistible, desirable thing in the world to do. People flocked here.
With tiny gated front gardens and back alleys for parking cars, these houses became known as Strivers Row. Its residents were striving to achieve America's middle-class dream. This was the heart of Harlem's new black community. The so-called new Negroes crowded into apartments all over the surrounding blocks. Neighborhood resident Helen Brown remembers. She had a room in a yellow brick building on 142nd Street, the home of a widely respected choral arranger named Hall Johnson. Brown was a member of Hall Johnson's Negro Choir, among the first to make spirituals popular beyond Harlem.
We were to specialize in spirituals, and I never knew what spirituals meant, because I was trying to do all the grand opera house, like Lily Pons and them would do.
As a boarder and a member of the choir, Brown met many of the great intellects and talents of her time.
They were all so very austere and very grand and very magnificent and very, they were ultra.
Writer Langston Hughes would never talk with his mouth full, she says, even if it meant going hungry at a soiree. And poet Count Cullen's shirt was so stiff he couldn't see over it, as Brown remembers it. Then there was singer Paul Robeson.
I said he looked like a Baptist preacher. And he had such a big roaring laugh.
But the Johnson home was only one of dozens of addresses where Harlemites met to banter. Several blocks away, Adams and I approach a humble red brick apartment building. If you look up before you cross 7th Avenue, you can see the letters YWCA stenciled above in weathered blue and white paint.
Now this is one of the most important places in terms of the Harlem Renaissance. Not only did Zora Neale Hurston stay here briefly, and not only did they debut their poetry or other literary achievements, but also the restaurant there was the favorite meeting place of the black literati of Harlem and during the Renaissance period, because the food was good, reliable, and inexpensive.
There's nothing in the main lounge but wood beam ceilings and a dusty fireplace. The building is now a homeless shelter. The only visible remnant of the history that unfurled here is a small iron plaque above a drinking fountain in the modern offices next door. It commemorates Madam C.J. Walker, the first black woman millionaire. She made her fortune selling hair products and running beauty salons.
This is so incredible, you know, because she taught black women who had the difficulty of how do they fit themselves into this white aesthetic that they find themselves having to deal with, how they could adapt their hair and stuff to that without being white.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Now this building across the way is another great monument of the Harlem Renaissance.
The Renaissance Casino spans an entire block of 7th Avenue, right next to the YWCA. Its red bricks and painted tiles are crumbling now, and its cavernous halls empty. But in the 20s, bands like Chick Webb brought Harlem's finest to their feet.
Here's the real Chick Webb specialty, breaking them down.
The ballroom held thousands of people and gave Harlemites a place to celebrate birthdays and weddings, watch the Harlem Wrens play basketball, and dance their nights away to the music that made Harlem swing.
They had a ballroom on practically every corner in Harlem, so you could go dancing at any time that you wanted to, and it was always live music, big bands, and then every night there were nightclubs.
Unlike the new Negro intellectuals, Frankie Manning wasn't interested in literature or high art. For him and for many of his contemporaries, the music and dance of Harlem were what defined its renaissance. Manning learned by watching his mother and friends at rent parties Harlem strivers held when they couldn't quite get their rent together.
The people was always laughing and joking and dancing and laughing, you know. And maybe one person would get out on the floor and the others would stand around clapping, go ahead, you know, and dancing. Just seemed like a happy, you know, happy thing to be doing, you know.
Manning invented some of the so-called air sets that made Harlem's Lindy Hop world famous. At the popular Savoy Ballroom, he literally threw his partner.
And Lindy Hop in, you pick her up quickly and you drop her quickly, you know. When it lifts you, it's pick up, you know, what else, things like that. And Lindy Hop would say, shoo, boom, yeah, okay.
Unfortunately, the Savoy Ballroom no longer exists. Most of Harlem's dance halls and theaters have been replaced by grocery stores or modern churches or parking lots or empty lots. But there is hope for the graffitied Renaissance Casino. A renovation is in the works.
Here behind you is another African-American landmark, a sort of unlikely thing to be a landmark, a funeral parlor.
You enter through a solemn Gothic archway under painted gold letters.
It was here in this space where the great, great singer Florence Mills had her funeral.
Practically all of Harlem attended. Florence Mills was beloved in Harlem for her flair and for her rise to world fame as an African-American singer and actress. Helen Brown remembers her return to Harlem after several years spent performing in Paris.
She wore a shade of pink that was so marvelous when she walked down the steps with this trail behind her. she said, Polly boo, wee, wee. And everybody had to stop. You could almost hear the breathing of everybody.
She died soon after, and suddenly, of appendicitis. The Hall Johnson Negro Choir and about 600 others sang at her funeral, and 200,000 mourners poured onto the now traffic-filled block of 7th Avenue.
And there are photographs where people are lined up on the rooftops of these buildings to get a look of the cortege going by.
When we came out from singing, there was a plane that went over with a man in it who let little blackbirds out.
Before Michael Adams goes home to rest his vocal cords, he takes me to the door of an angular red brick church further down 7th Avenue. Salem United Methodist's pastor adopted and raised young poet Kaunte Cullen, one of the few new Negro writers who actually grew up in Harlem. Cullen is sometimes criticized for trying too hard to fit a traditional white aesthetic, but Adams defends him.
Even if Kaunte Cullen tried to speak in a voice that had already been established by Keats or Shelley, he did it in such a winning and an incredible way. I mean, you know, the economy and charm of his little poem, which, let's see, how does it go? She thinks that even up in heaven, while her kind sleeps and snores, colored cherubs rise at seven to do celestial chores. And he's great.
We peer into what are now the church offices, the dining room where Cullen ate meals with his family, and the study where he must have toiled over his poems. Our footsteps echo through the church auditorium below Romanesque arches, where Cullen was married to the daughter of the renowned black scholar W.E.B. Du Bois. Adams could go on forever. We've traveled fewer than 10 blocks, and he seems to find a little piece of history in every nook and cranny. But it's almost dark outside, and the rest of his stories can wait for another tour. Harlem's history will still be here. I'm Marianne McCune for The Savvy Traveler.